More impeachment hearings today. Today's star witness told lawmakers, stop spreading conspiracies about Ukraine.
In the course of this investigation, I would ask that you please not promote politically driven falsehoods that so clearly advance Russian interests. As Republicans and Democrats have agreed for decades, Ukraine is a valued partner of the United States, and it plays an important role in our national security.
Far away from Washington in northern Syria, President Trump has moved American troops out of towns and cities and toward oil fields. This has given some Syrians the impression that their lives don't matter.
Some liquid popping out of the ground is more valuable than their blood. This is how they see it.
And cricket is going pink.
We are ready for the pink ball test. Are you?
We are ready for the pink ball test match. Are you?
Oh, we're so ready. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for joining us today. With the impeachment hearings monopolizing the news this week, it's easy for us Americans to forget that other parts of the world are not so riveted by the drama in Washington. Even Ukrainians, they've got other things to do, like commemorating the 6th anniversary of an uprising there. We'll hear more about the Maidan Revolution later in the program, but first to Washington, where again attention is focused on that other Ukraine-related saga.
Some of you on this committee appear to believe that Russia and its security services did not conduct a campaign against our country, and that perhaps, somehow, for some reason, Ukraine did.
That's Fiona Hill. She's an expert on Russia and the former Soviet Union. She was an advisor to the Trump administration, but resigned in July. The World's Matthew Bell has been on the impeachment inquiry for us all week and watched today's proceedings. We just heard a bit of Fiona Hill's opening statement there, Matthew. What was the broader point she was trying to make?
So just a bit more background on Fiona Hill. She's an experienced national security expert. She was on the National Security Council reporting to John Bolton, the former national security advisor for Donald Trump. Hill is also the author of a well-regarded biography on Vladimir Putin. She's a fierce critic of Putin, Putin's policies out of Russia. So in her relatively short opening statement this morning, she went out of her way to make this to make two points. One was that she takes this impeachment inquiry very seriously, she said. But one thing she does not take seriously are some of the conspiracy theories that the Republicans have alluded to as this story has played out. And here's why.
In the course of this investigation, I would ask that you please not promote politically driven falsehoods that so clearly advance Russian interests. As Republicans and Democrats have agreed for decades, Ukraine is a valued partner of the United States, and it plays an important role in our national security. And as I told the committee last month, I refuse to be part of an effort to legitimize an alternate narrative that the Ukrainian government is a U.S. adversary and that Ukraine, not Russia, attacked us in 2016.
She was pretty blunt there. How did the Republicans respond to that?
Devin Nunes is the ranking member. He responded by addressing it sort of preemptively in his own opening remarks. As he's done before, he said that he disparaged the Democrats. He disparaged this whole process, calling it a kangaroo court. He said this thing has moved from the Russia hoax to the shoddy Ukraine sequel. But on this GOP line of questioning that Ukraine was indeed meddling in the 2016 elections, and Nunes said that the Democrats were colluding with the Ukrainians, Nunes did not back down.
Needless to say, it is entirely possible for two separate nations to engage in election meddling at the same time, and Republicans believe we should take meddling seriously by all foreign countries, regardless of which campaign is the target.
Nunes also held up a report written by the Republicans in Congress about Russian meddling that was put out back in 2018.
I'm going to ask my staff to hand these reports to our two witnesses today just so they can have a recollection of their memory.
So as the back and forth got underway and Fiona Hill had a chance to respond to that, what did she say?
Hill sort of took the committee back in time looking at the 2016 election. She said that she had no interest in tipping the scales one way or another on the question of impeachment, but she wants the facts to be heard because of what's at stake, she said, for U.S. national security.
The goal of the Russians was really to put whoever became the president by trying to tip their hands on one side of the scale under a cloud. So if Secretary, former First Lady, former Senator Clinton had been elected as president, as indeed many expected in the run-up to the election in 2016, she too would have had major questions about her legitimacy.
So Hill is describing a basic disinformation campaign there. Something that the Republicans have pointed to are examples of Ukrainian government officials saying disparaging things about Donald Trump. They've suggested that Trump naturally was worried that Ukraine was out to get him. Did Fiona Hill give any context there?
She did. And those quotes are out there. You can find them on the internet. There's a Politico article from 2017. It was mentioned a couple of times in this hearing today. This was written by journalist Ken Vogel. Fiona Hill said that she remembers when the story came out, includes quotes from Ukrainians criticizing Trump, praising Hillary Clinton. She said that the Ukrainians basically bet on the wrong horse. But she also went on to point on something else about this story.
However, I do want to point out that the crux of the article here by Mr. Vogel is he said there was little evidence of a top-down effort by Ukraine. And he makes a distinction between the Russian effort that was personally directed by Russian President Putin and involved the country's military and foreign intelligence services. Now, I don't think that those two things are exactly the same.
So also testifying today, Marco, was David Holmes. He serves at the U.S. Embassy in Ukraine, but it was really Fiona Hill that took the spotlight. And tomorrow, no hearings.
The World's Matthew Bell, thank you, as always.
Thank you.
Let's shift focus now to Syria. Last month, as you'll recall, President Trump announced that the U.S. was pulling troops out of northeastern Syria, but the U.S. did not pull troops out entirely. The Trump administration shifted them around. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
These days, almost every time President Trump talks about Syria, he goes back to the same message.
We're keeping the oil. We have the oil is secure. We left troops behind only for the oil.
But what we do is we did keep the oil, if you don't mind. We kept the oil. And we'll distribute that oil. We'll help out the Kurds and we'll help out other people. We'll also help out ourselves if that's okay.
Taking the oil, keeping the oil, helping ourselves to the oil. These are phrases the president has repeated many times over the past few weeks. His focus on oil in Syria seemingly began last month when he first announced that American troops are leaving, only to reverse that decision a little later. This time, Trump said American troops have a new mission, to guard the oil fields.
And what I intend to do, perhaps, is make a deal with an ExxonMobil or one of our great companies to go in there and do it properly. Right now, it's
these statements have left experts scratching their heads.
It's really not possible for us to exploit those oil resources unless we want to be oil smugglers. And that's not something the United States of America, I think, is into. So I'm not sure what he has in mind.
Brett McGurk served as a special envoy for the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS from 2015 to 2018. He was speaking at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in Washington back in October. And like McGurk, Elizabeth Surkoff says what the president is claiming is illegal. Surkoff is Syria expert at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, a think tank in Philadelphia.
Pillaging of natural resources of an occupied territory is a war crime, so the U.S. would not be able to do this.
On the ground, though, American troops have been shifting to new positions in northern Syria, where most of the country's oil fields are. Local reporters have captured footage of Humvees with American flags. In the background, huge oil pumps bob up and down.
It's actually quite beautiful if you drive around there. There's a lot of agriculture. The northeast of Syria is also used to be the breadbasket of Syria. It produces a lot of grain and other types of crops.
Wim Zwijnenberg works for PAX, a Dutch organization that focuses on peace building. He's written about the impact of war on Syria's oil industry. He says even before the civil war, Syria wasn't a major global oil producer. And when the war got underway, Zwijnenberg says, it crippled the country's oil and gas industries.
Engineers fled the country. People were killed who worked on site.
By 2014, the Islamic State had gained considerable territory in Syria, and it had managed to take over some of the oil fields. The group made money by selling that oil to middlemen, who then sold it to others, including the Syrian government. Soon, the U.S. and its coalition partners realized that if they wanted to take out ISIS, they would have to cut off its financial lifeline, the oil revenues.
So there was a massive bombing campaign and over 4,000 oil targets were destroyed in the last 4 years.
That's why for the U.S. to benefit financially from the oil in Syria, it would have to first invest in rebuilding the infrastructure.
It requires millions and millions of investments to rebuild Syria's oil industry for them to compensate for all the money they've invested in the operation.
The goal of the U.S. in northeastern Syria is to make sure the oil fields don't fall into the hands of the Islamic State. That's according to Pentagon spokesperson Sean Robertson, who answered a few questions over email. But Darin Khalifa, Syria analyst for the International Crisis Group, thinks there is something else going on here.
Trump's senior advisors have used the oil to convince the president to remain in Syria or to retain a residual force in Syria, which was a winning argument that played on his instincts, of course, his transactional instincts.
And who exactly pitched this idea? Again, Elizabeth Zirkoff with Foreign Policy Research Institute in Philadelphia.
Retired General Keane, who appears a lot on Fox News, Lindsey Graham, who's in Congress, and basically people inside the administration, such as James Jeffrey, the special envoy to Syria, Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State.
Trump liked the idea. He could say to his base that, hey, not only did we reduce the troops in Syria, but we also made a deal that benefits the U.S. financially. The problem is, none of that turned out to be true so far. The troops that the president said he's bringing back home are still in Syria, guarding the oil. And there's no oil deal yet. In the meantime, Turkish, Russian, and Syrian forces have taken control of northeastern Syria. It's been chaos since Trump announced last month that American troops were leaving the Syrian-Turkish border. Estimates vary, but dozens of civilians have died in clashes and more than 100,000 people have been displaced. Elizabeth Zirkoff says many Syrians in that area are disappointed with Trump's decision to station troops only at the oil fields.
You know, the sense that their lives do not matter, but the oil in the ground does, is something that is very difficult for people to accept. You know, some liquid popping out of the ground is more valuable than their blood. This is how they see it.
Yet Karam Shar, who left Syria in 2016 and now lives in New Zealand, says he doesn't take Trump's words at face value.
He has made similar remarks on Iraq, also in Libya. To me, I feel less bad simply because I know this is just rhetoric.
Shar has researched and written about Syria's oil industry. He says watching American troops guard the oil fields while Turkish, Russian, and Syrian forces attack civilians makes him feel terrible. But he knows that this idea of the U.S. making money out of Syria's oil...
None of this is possible. Even if the president wants to do that, I don't think the Pentagon would approve of it. Even if the Pentagon approves of that, no oil company would be willing to go and steal other countries' oil.
American oil companies might not want the PR headache, he says, to tap into a tiny amount of the global oil supply. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Kolkata, India has gone pink. Buildings and bridges bathed in pink light. A pink blimp floats above the city. The excitement is all around another thing that's bright pink, a cricket ball.
We are ready for the pink ball test. Are you?
We are ready for the pink ball test match. Are you?
That's a video from the Board for Control of Cricket in India. India and Bangladesh are kicking off a test match tomorrow. So why switch to a pink ball after centuries of using red balls? Traditionally, test cricket is played during the day. But a few years ago, cricket's governing bodies began to worry that day matches limited TV viewership. So along comes nighttime cricket. They lit up stadiums and experimented with a few ball colors that were easier to see. Yellow and orange paled in comparison to pink. Tomorrow's pink test match will only be the 12th one played in the history of the sport. The head of cricket in India, Sourav Ganguly, is into it.
You can see on the Ganges a pink boat. Lit pink boat goes around the Ganges, which takes...
Wow, pink boat. I'm not even into cricket, and I'm excited. I think pink said it best. Get this party started. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. There are a lot of ways to get across a political message. A cheap and effective one is to buy a political ad on social media, like Facebook. But there's a big debate about how Facebook and other companies should police these ads. The World's Lydia Emanuelidou has more.
Like a lot of what you're hearing in the news these days, this story also has a Ukraine connection.
Joe Biden promised Ukraine $1 billion if they fired the prosecutor investigating his son's company.
This is an ad the Trump campaign ran on Facebook last month. The claims in it are verifiably false, but when the Biden campaign asked Facebook to remove the ad, the company said basically no, that they don't want to be in the business of policing political speech. This was really controversial, and it put Facebook on the defensive. Here's CEO Mark Zuckerberg being questioned by New York Democrat Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez during a congressional hearing last month.
So you won't take down lies, or you will take down lies? I think this is just a pretty simple yes or no.
Congresswoman,
I'm not talking about spin. I'm talking about actual
disinformation. Yes, in most cases, in a democracy, okay. I believe that people should be able to see for themselves what politicians that they may or may not vote for.
So
are
you won't take them down.
Okay, you get the point. Now, a few days after that, Twitter announced that it would ban all political ads. And just yesterday, Google announced new worldwide restrictions on political advertising. A disclosure here that Google is one of our funders. A Google spokesperson talked to me about their policy change earlier today, but she didn't want me to record the conversation. She told me that Google won't be taking down false or misleading political ads except in certain cases, like if a politician buys an ad to spread false information about when and where people should go to vote. By the way, Facebook has carved out similar exceptions. But what Google is doing is limiting so-called micro-targeting, which allows advertisers to target specific audiences by race, interests, and other categories. Google says it's limiting those to age, gender, and zip code. And this could have big implications, says Josh Feldberg with the UK-based marketing company 89UP, because he says online advertising has become critical to political campaigns.
It's everything. I mean, I spend my life doing it, so I can tell you that. It's huge.
This is especially true in places like the UK, where political advertising is prohibited on TV and radio around elections. Feldberg says he'll be watching how Twitter and Google's new rules affect advertising in the lead up to next month's general election in the UK. Both companies said they're implementing their new policies ahead of that election. But Feldberg says it shouldn't be up to the tech platforms to make these changes.
We rely so much on these platforms to be self-regulating. But the reality is they are reacting to public backlash. And the only way to deal with this is to actually legislate more. You know, these platforms come from a kind of very libertarian sort of Silicon Valley approach to things, which is very different to what actually works in the real world if we want to preserve our democracy.
Zeynep Tufekci agrees with this. She's a techno-sociologist at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She says that Facebook is one of the biggest players in the political advertising space, and she wants them to take more action on political ads.
The micro-targeting, the way especially Facebook has done, has been a pernicious force.
Here's an example from the run-up to the Brexit referendum in 2016.
There were micro-targeted ads on Facebook that claimed, among other things, that Turkey, the country I'm originally from, was about to enter the EU and there would be 80 million Turks invading Britain, basically.
This wasn't true.
And it didn't go to everyone. It didn't go to people who would naturally be skeptical of it. It only went to the people who would be gullible to it.
This, she says, is a big problem, and she hopes Google's decision to limit micro-targeting puts pressure on Facebook to do the same. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
2 years ago, Kenya passed the world's most serious plastic bag ban, but that did not stop the pollution, so now Kenya is raising the stakes. It's banning single-use plastics from beaches and parks starting next June. Coastal communities in Kenya want the government to speed things up. They say plastic containers, bottles, and straws that pollute the oceans are endangering their livelihoods. The BBC's Emmanuel Igunza sent this report from the Indian Ocean coast of Kenya.
I'm in Watamu. This is one of Kenya's most popular coastal getaways. It's well known for its pristine waters and sandy beaches. Every year, thousands of tourists come here to watch breathtaking marine life. But the lifeline of this resort town is under serious threat. The coastal region is one of Kenya's biggest producers of fish, and millions of people depend on fishing for survival. But a United Nations report says an increase in plastic pollution, overfishing and climate change have all led to disappearance of fish, which is endangering livelihoods in places like this. Alfred Kenga has been a fisherman here in Watamu for nearly 30 years and says he's seen the effects of the pollution.
Plastic waste is a serious threat to all types of fish because they die when they eat that waste. So when we are out in deep sea and we see any plastic waste scattered all over, we normally stop and pick it up and dispose of it properly once we get back on shore, because this is a big danger to our fish.
But the residents in Watamu have initiated a campaign to take on the plastic waste problem. Every week, volunteers clean up the coastline, collecting tons of waste, which will then be taken to a recycling center run by the community. At the recycling plant, plastics are weighed before grinding them into tiny pieces that are sold to make chairs, poles and tables. Plastic and glass bottles are bound together and can be used to replace brick walls in homes. Julie Alego is EcoWorld's project coordinator.
On the other side of the compound, as you've seen, we have so many glass bottles and plastic bottles that we receive from the tourism industry, as well as some of the beach cleanups that we do. So what we do is to show people simple and practical ways that they can use to transform the waste that they have into something of value and also that has monetary benefits.
The community here sees this project as part of support for the government's ban on plastic carry bags imposed 2 years ago. In June next year, Kenya plans to have a total ban on single plastic use in beaches, national parks, forests and conservation areas. It's a move welcomed by environmentalists like Julia Lego.
We're trying to change the mindset of people from looking at waste as something ugly and start looking at it as a resource. In that way, they'll go out to look for it in the environment, to use it in making one or two things that they are interested in, thus reducing the amount of waste in the environment. And in that way, you know, end up with a clean environment.
Plastic pollution is one of the most pressing environmental problems globally. But communities such as this one in Watamu hope that such initiatives to clean up the environment can be replicated elsewhere and give momentum to a cleaner future.
The BBC's Emmanuel Igunza there reporting from Watamu, coastal Kenya. You're with the world. Traditional Chinese medicine looks at the connection between body and nature, between yin and yang.
Yin is more nurturing, cooling, calming, and the yang is active, hot.
Traditional Chinese medicine is now being recognized by the World Health Organization, and it's causing an uproar among some Western scientists. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. Despite the central role of Ukraine in the impeachment hearings in Washington, the top news of the day in Ukraine is not impeachment. Ukrainians are focused on the six-year anniversary of taking to the streets.
Ukraine is facing a political crisis this morning as demonstrators face off with police in riot gear blocking the entrances to government buildings.
Anti-government protesters in Ukraine today staged a massive rally in Kiev, the biggest yet.
The protests in Ukraine were sparked essentially by choosing sides. Did Ukraine want an alliance with Russia or the European Union? Ukraine's president at the time, Viktor Yanukovych, leaned toward Russia, but the majority of Ukrainians wanted closer ties with the West. So when Yanukovych rejected an agreement with the EU in favor of a trade deal with Russia, a revolution broke out. Thousands of people camped out in the central square in Kyiv, the Maidan. Then things escalated. In February of 2014, riot police shot at the protesters. More than 100 people were killed. Days later, President Yanukovych fled Ukraine and resettled in Russia. The World's Daniel Hoffman is just back from Ukraine. Daniel, today Ukrainians celebrate what they call a day of dignity and freedom. What is behind that phrase?
So many here in the West and the United States call that revolution, the revolution that happened in 2014, the Maidan Revolution or Euromaidan. But people in Ukraine call it the Revolution of Dignity. And the reason they call it that is this revolution restored dignity to the Ukrainian people. For Ukrainians, it was a success. They got rid of Viktor Yanukovych. They got rid of that Russian influence and started a new path for Ukraine, a path that leads towards closer ties to the U.S. and to Europe.
And the corruption and undignified character of Mr. Yanukovych. So why is commemorating these protests so significant for Ukraine today?
Well, back in 2013 and 2014, this was a top story here in the United States. We covered it every day. There was full coverage. A lot of Western publications sent journalists to Ukraine, to Maidan, to cover these protests. So now in Ukraine, 6 years later, the Revolution of Dignity is still top of mind. It's still really important to many Ukrainians. When I visited Ukraine recently, I visited the Maidan Square with my translator and guide, Alek Sardaryan. Alek was a protester himself at the time, and he told me about the moment the snipers started shooting.
The snipers were shooting from the roof of that hotel. Mostly, like, people were burning tires to make this, you know, dark smoke, black smoke, to hide themselves, you know, for snipers and riflemen not to know where to shoot. There was a joke that like every decent person in Ukraine smells like a campfire.
So it was an earth-shattering moment for Ukraine, and in many ways it's still super relevant because of the war that's going on right now in eastern Ukraine.
Right, a war that actually began in early 2014, kind of while the whole Maidan revolution is seething. War breaks out in eastern Ukraine. It continues, as you say, to this day. What is the connection between the Maidan revolution and the fighting in eastern Ukraine?
So essentially, when that revolution was happening, when there was a vacuum in power, Russia took advantage of that moment. Ukraine was vulnerable, and Russia swept in, annexed Crimea, and invaded the Donbas region in eastern Ukraine. So Ukrainians understand that, and they make that direct connection between the revolution and Russia's continued aggression in the eastern part of their country.
So today there are protests all across the globe that are hitting many of the same themes the Maidan revolution hit upon. Who do the people want to be associated with? How do people establish national dignity? So with what's happening today in many places, is there a connection back to the Maidan in 2014?
Yeah, it's actually been interesting to see the connection between today's protests in Hong Kong and Ukraine's Revolution of Dignity. So back in September, we saw protesters in Hong Kong organize screenings of the Netflix film Winter on Fire, which is all about the Revolution of Dignity. And many Hong Kongers look to Ukraine and look to Ukraine's revolution as an inspiration. At the same time, today, on this day of dignity and freedom in Ukraine, many Ukrainians are expressing support for the Hong Kong protesters.
Wow, that's fascinating. You say, Daniel, that the impeachment trial is not top of the news there in Ukraine. Maybe not wall-to-wall coverage, but is it still being talked about?
It is still being talked about. Most people aren't following the day-to-day TikTok of every impeachment hearing and every statement. However, the way it's being represented overall on television, at least, is that this is a huge political fiasco, that Americans are watching this as if they're watching reality TV. The Ukrainian media is talking about the fact that many bars in D.C. are televising these impeachments, and people are watching it like they would watch sports.
Yeah, for many people, it is a reality show. The World's Daniel Hoffman. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
President Trump isn't the only world leader in hot water. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was indicted today on corruption charges involving a quid pro quo with a telecom tycoon. Netanyahu is actually charged in three separate cases of fraud and breach of trust. He's also the first sitting Israeli prime minister charged with bribery. Amir Fuchs is a researcher at the Israel Democracy Institute.
The big case of bribery is for giving regulatory benefits for Shaul Alovich, which was head of Bezek, and he got, at least on the accusations, benefits of worth of hundreds of millions of shekels.
Bezek, that is Israel's biggest telecom company, and apparently Benjamin Netanyahu is trying to leverage a better image for himself.
Yes. He has a popular news site in Israel, which is called Bwala. And in this news site, Netanyahu and his family and his advisors could actually dictate what will be published, and mainly positive articles about Netanyahu and some negative articles about his opponent. This is the most important case.
In his announcement today, Israel's attorney general said a day when a sitting prime minister is indicted on corruption charges is a sad and difficult one. No one is above the law. I mean, Israeli courts have made it clear that you cannot serve as a minister in parliament once you've been indicted. But what about a prime minister?
Yeah, this is a legal question that we never faced because we never had an acting prime minister indicted. When Olmert was indicted, he already resigned before the indictment. So we don't have a precedent for that.
Yeah, Ehud Olmert, the former prime minister.
Yes, Ehud Olmert. You said correctly that there are precedents of the court deciding that a minister cannot act while he has corruption indictment against him. Although the law, the basic law of government, doesn't say anything about that, the law doesn't also say anything about the prime minister. So there is a question here. The outcome of a resignation of the prime minister is a resignation of the whole government. So it's not the same question, and the Supreme Court will have to decide that.
Well, the opposition in Israel, I see, is already calling for Netanyahu's resignation, seeing a potential political opening here. Is this the end of the road for Netanyahu?
It's really not likely that he will resign right away. As we speak, he's now live speaking and attacking the prosecution and actually claiming that he was persecuted. So there is still time to...
Yeah, he called it a witch hunt.
Yeah, a witch hunt. I think that it's clear that it will still take time, but it's hard to see how he gets out of that, because even if he can postpone and ask for immunity and things will take time, and if there will be another election, it is not a big chance that he will get what he lacks now, and he lacks 6 mandates in the parliament to get a majority, and it will be difficult for him to get that after the indictment. So it might be the beginning of the end, yes.
The phrase quid pro quo has been surging through the impeachment inquiry here in the U.S. I noticed you used quid pro quo as well, because all of the charges against Netanyahu are essentially one thing in exchange for another. Have Israeli media also been using a lot of Latin lately?
No, we say it in Hebrew. We don't say it in Latin, but people, and I'm saying it because, you know, I'm a lawyer, so the main issue that divides breach of trust and bribery is the quid pro quo. But no, it's not really in the media because we say it in Hebrew.
What is quid pro quo in Hebrew? Leave us with that.
The davar tmurat davar, the thing in exchange of a thing.
Dr. Amir Fuchs with the Israel Democracy Institute, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
The video shows a nightmarish scene in Mexico. A man tells his kids to take cover during a shootout last month in Culiacán. Battles broke out after the military arrested the son of Joaquin El Chapo Guzman. But security forces were outgunned, and El Chapo's son was let go. Just one stark example of the power of the cartels. But Mexico is not in this fight alone. For years, it's partnered with the U.S. to battle organized crime. Here's the world's Monica Campbell.
First, a trained dog smelled the drugs. Then an X-ray revealed the stash in the trailer heading in from Mexico.
It was carrying about 100 packages of fentanyl and I believe over 300 packages of methamphetamines.
That's Michael Humphreys, a U.S. border official at a press conference this year in Nogales, Arizona. He's standing near stacks of plastic bags filled with pills and powder. Then a reporter asked,
"Was it supposed to be carrying?"
What was the truck supposed to be carrying?
Well, it was carrying produce. In the interior of the trailer, there was produce, cucumbers.
Cucumbers. Other times, it's drugs hidden in trunks and gas tanks. The Arizona bust was big, but typical in terms of how drugs get to the U.S., through busy checkpoints, as a result of corruption on both sides. Tony Wayne was U.S. ambassador to Mexico under President Obama.
It doesn't just get to the border and then become catapulted to Boston or Chicago or other places. There's supply infrastructure to deliver it on both sides of that border.
That infrastructure, plus demand for drugs in the U.S., keeps Mexican cartels pulling in billions of dollars a year. David Shirk is a professor at the University of San Diego who studies Mexico and the fight against organized crime.
The amount of profitability from drug trafficking means that you can corrupt entire police corporations. You can corrupt high-level government officials. And you can buy enough firepower to cow the federal government in Mexico.
In 2008, the U.S. and Mexico pledged to fight organized crime. It was a $3 billion plan that funded military equipment like helicopters and also helped train police, go after money laundering, and strengthen Mexico's courts. But success is hard to spot. Today, violence in Mexico is increasing again. And cartels don't just deal in drugs anymore. There's human trafficking, oil theft, and extortion. Mexico's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, is still leaning on the military to fight crime, but also has a new approach that he puts quite simply.
Abrazos, no balazos.
Hugs, not bullets. Let's avoid all-out battles, he says.
That has proved to be, so far, a total failure.
Mónica Serrano, a crime expert in Mexico City, says it's a failure because cartels don't feel threatened by a simple military presence. At the same time, she says, more military isn't the answer either. Sure, security forces eventually captured El Chapo, but others took his place.
So what would it take to try to put in place the right kind of policies? I really don't know.
This much is clear, she says. Mexico can't win while there's a demand for drugs in the U.S.
That ends up cornering Mexico in a situation in which, damn if you do, if you resort to more firepower, mobilized military means, and damn if you don't, as is happening right now with López Obrador.
President López Obrador says he wants to focus on fighting corruption and funding education and jobs to keep young people from joining cartels. Meanwhile, President Trump is focused on the border wall and migration. Mexico is working with Trump to try and keep migrants away from the U.S., but a new agreement on fighting organized crime may get tougher after gunmen ambushed a U.S.-Mexican family this month in Mexico. Six children were killed. Trump said it was, quote, time for Mexico, with the help of the United States, to wage war on the drug cartels. It was unclear what Trump was offering exactly, but López Obrador rejected any hint of intervention.
Creo que no.
No, he said. We need to protect Mexico's national sovereignty, a key feature of the country's foreign policy. To former Ambassador Wayne, it was a sign of tension, just as Mexico and the U.S. must work together because of the stakes.
In the United States, it's the tens of thousands who are dying from overdoses. And in Mexico, it's the tens of thousands, over 30,000 last year, who died from violent homicides, much of which is fueled by drug-related crime.
And there's one request that many people in Mexico ask of the U.S., stop the flow of guns into Mexico. Oscar Minas is a criminologist who lives in El Paso, Texas, but works across the border in Ciudad Juarez.
Es extremadamente fácil y se ha visto con estas tiendas que venden armamento en las.
He says there are stores, pawn shops, individuals selling weapons all along the border, from assault rifles to pistols, you name it.
Y hay bandas bien organizadas que pasan por distribuidores y vendedores legales.
Minas says criminals use straw buyers or someone with a clean record who can buy several guns at once. Current U.S. officials wouldn't grant an interview to talk about anti-gun trafficking efforts at the border. But back in 2017, some members of Congress did introduce a bill to make this trafficking a federal crime. It has not gone anywhere. For the World, I'm Monica Campbell.
When you go to the doctor, you might get your blood pressure or cholesterol checked, but what about a yin deficiency in your kidney? A traditional Chinese medical practitioner could check this. The World Health Organization is now recognizing some of these practices, but in Europe, not everyone is on board with that. Here's the World's Ilana Gordon.
Hi.
Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
I'm Kwan. Nice to meet you.
Kwan Zhou leads Michael Campanelli into an exam room. They're at the New England School of Acupuncture in Worcester, Massachusetts.
You know, I had one of those workouts where you've pushed yourself too much. This time of year, when the winter hits, I get seasonal affective disorder. So it could be both the mind and the body.
How is your, like, sleep?
Zhou is a traditional Chinese medicine practitioner. She trained in Beijing and says she was first drawn to the ancient roots of a practice that's still highly respected in Asia.
And let me see your tongue, please. Thank you. It's not rosy red enough. So it's like pale lavender. So it's a deficiency of yang. The yang is not strong enough.
Zhou views a person's health through the connection between the body and nature and a philosophy of yin and yang.
Yin is more nurturing, cooling, calming, and the yang is active, hot.
Health problems are a sign of imbalance.
So I'm preparing the needles.
By this point, Campanelli is lying down on his left side on an exam table. Zhou places very thin acupuncture needles in his cheeks, the back of his neck, and his hip.
Those needles are so sharp, you don't even know they're going in.
He feels a twitch.
Yeah, that's a very good sign of twitching. Yeah. We call it arrival of qi.
Mm-hmm. Joe says qi arrives through different channels of energy called meridians.
We summon some soldier to work for us.
This session may seem quite different from a standard medical appointment, but on the global stage, meridians and qi are having a moment. For the first time, the World Health Organization is including a section on traditional Chinese medicine in its upcoming guide for diagnosing and classifying diseases.
This shows the world is multidimensional. So this is great.
Song Chin Ki is a traditional Chinese doctor who has been practicing in the UK for 30 years. He says he hopes the new WHO manual will promote his field around the world.
Or even hopefully let this medicine play a bigger role for people's health or prevention.
But the new recognition is fueling an uproar among top science and medical groups in Europe. Dan Larhammar is president of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences.
Well, we were quite astonished to see something like that, which has no scientific support, to be included in a document that is so widely used across the world.
Larhammar chairs a coalition of European Academies of Science and Medicine. This month, the group issued a warning about the WHO's decision.
Because if unproven methods are claimed to be useful, then we are risking the health of the patients.
His group is calling for more stringent regulation of traditional Chinese medicine across Europe, and specifically a crackdown on claims of some herbal remedies. Larhammar says the World Health Organization runs the risk of legitimizing quack assertions about cure-alls for cancer and other diseases.
Nobody has been able to define a meridian or an acupuncture point. No one can say what diameter an acupuncture point has or how deep it is in the skin. It's still totally unknown. And the most likely explanation for that is that they probably don't exist.
We need to be open-minded. Each kind of medicine has its own merit. So we should learn each other.
Song Chin Ki, the traditional practitioner in the UK, says medicine of any kind should strive for best practices to filter out quacks. He hopes the World Health Organization's update will help advance that.
World Health Organization is about the world and it's a health. Health can be many, many forms of the health system.
In a statement, the WHO said the inclusion of traditional Chinese medicine in its manual is not an endorsement of any practice. The point is to be a universal system to track and understand health around the world. Dominik Ehrnich is a doctor at the University of Munich. He heads a pain center at the hospital there, and he's also president of the German Acupuncture Association. Ehrnich has been following the uproar in Europe and thinks there's reason for it.
But on the other hand, it's a little bit exaggerated.
Ehrnich says there is some medical evidence for certain traditional approaches, like acupuncture for chronic pain.
For example, in Germany, it's well accepted by most likely the patients and many doctors because they are very familiar and they use it.
But he says it's best incorporated under the umbrella of modern medicine, where it can be scrutinized and where practitioners have backgrounds in science, too.
So I will do a little popping on your back.
Back inside the Massachusetts clinic, Kwan Zhou places glass cups on Michael Campanelli's back. They suck the skin inside. She says it's to address a stagnation in qi and improve his circulation.
That made the blood vessel relaxed,
So that wake them up to have them do a better job for you.
Is this the kind that Michael Phelps wore as a swimmer?
Yes, yes.
Campanelli seems satisfied.
Do you have herbs in front?
On his way out, he asks for a special herb that he says helps with his allergies.
Not having to take a pill for every ache and pain, I'm absolutely a believer in it.
Does your regular doctor know that you do this?
No, he does not. No, he doesn't, but I probably should tell him.
Campanelli drove up an hour for the appointment at this acupuncture school. He says it was worth the trip. For The World, Alana Gordon, Worcester, Massachusetts.
A quick recap of today's impeachment hearings. The witnesses, Dr. Fiona Hill, the top Russia expert on the National Security Council, and David Holmes, a diplomat in the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv. The big takeaways, Republicans have argued that Trump was justified in wanting to investigate alleged Ukrainian meddling in the 2016 election. Hill fought back hard against that.
In the course of this investigation, I would ask that you please not promote politically driven falsehoods that so clearly advance Russian interests.
The other big point today, pressure. David Holmes said Ukraine's president felt he had no choice. If he wanted to come to the White House and receive military aid, then announce investigations into the 2016 U.S. elections and energy company Burisma, where Hunter Biden was a board member. Here's Committee Chair Adam Schiff questioning Holmes.
So you're acknowledging, I think, Mr. Holmes, are you not, that Ukraine very much felt pressured to undertake these investigations, that the president, Rudy Giuliani, and Ambassador Sondland and others were demanding?
Yes, sir.
Republicans said investigating Burisma was part of a broad anti-corruption campaign in Ukraine. Hill and Holmes said no, it was about the Bidens. Here the two are questioned by the Democratic lawyer, Dan Goldman.
It was very apparent to me that that was what Rudy Giuliani intended, yes. Intended to convey that Burisma was linked to the Bidens, and he said this publicly, repeatedly.
And Mr. Holmes, you also understood that Burisma was code for Biden's?
Yes.
Hill and Holmes painted a picture of competing paths, one of them where diplomats were working toward U.S. foreign policy goals, a second in which the president's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, Ambassador Gordon Sondland, and others were carrying out the president's personal political aims. Hill recounted a meeting with Sondland.
And I did say to him, Ambassador Sondland, Gordon, I think this is all going to blow up, and here we are.
Yep, here we are. And that's where we leave things today. From the world's Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.